Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, busy week. Just back from a couple days in Ocean City, Maryland. I was calling residents in Ocean City at what they call the Worcester County Kollel. And it's a big treat this week, because I'm going to be doing two. I'm planning anyway, packed week of doing two yard site talks. One is Reb Chaim Brisker, I think it's today or yesterday or something. And you can't let that one go by. That's number one. And number two, a friend of mine asked me to do a yard site podcast about her grandfather. It was sort of a famous person, Reb Chaim Brisker, but hope to get to that maybe tomorrow. So those who are interested, you'll have two play with this week if I can provide a time and circumstances permit. Also, I mentioned that I'm doing the Baltimore tour on Sunday. And without any further ado, let's get down to business. Because, as I said, this week is the yard sale of Chaim Soloveitchik, Chaim Brisker. Can't get a bigger name than that. Although I think a lot of people heard about more than understand who this person was. A very, very interesting person. And to put some historical flesh and blood on this, because Reb Chaim is such a great person, and now they're coming out with biographies all the time, at least I see them in this store, and probably they're all, you know, hagiographic and so forth, so you're not sure how to separate the wheat from the chaff. And there's no way I can do justice, even in, I'm going to try to keep myself short this time. Last time with Ritzel Petter went too long, and then the thing closed down on me. So I'll try to keep this as short as humanly possible. To give you at least a handle, at least as I see it, of Reb Chaim Brisker, who is a historical figure, not just an interesting personality and biography, historical figure in modernity, and I'll try to explain why. First of all, who are we talking about? Those who don't know, Reb Chaim Brisker, they call him Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, was a big rabbi, first a rashi, then a rabbi. Two separate roles, I'll talk about that. In Lithuania in the second half of the 1800s, early part of the 1900s. So he lived from 1853 and he died in 1918 during World War I. That's not such a long life. That's 66. He was 66 when he died. I'm just saying, he's a great person. He didn't live to be 80, 90 or something like that. You know, 66 is not so old. And very interesting in many ways. First of all, he's the son of the father, but he's more than just the son of the father. Sometimes these famous people have the fortune or misfortune that, you know, since the father was the Maharal, he'll always be known just as the son of the Maharal, or the brother of, the Vilna Gaon, he'll always be known as brother of Vilna Gaon. It's very interesting. Chaim Soloveitchik is the son of Yosef Soloveitchik of the Beis Halevi. These are two famous names. But nobody says he's the son of this guy or the brother of that guy. He's a big person on his own. Now, what are we talking about? Here's somebody who was born, I think, in Volozhin. So his father, Chaim Soloveitchik's father, was related to the founder of the Volozhin Yeshiva, Chaim Volozhiner. On the other hand, all the Litvish yeshivas have the problem of family, nepotism, and who gets to run the show. And I'm talking about even, I don't mean nepotism when they're not worthy. You can have nepotism when you're worthy, you know. But why did this particular genius get picked over that one? Because this one is a son-in-law and so and such and such. Now, in the case of Volozhin, the funny thing goes like this. The founder was Reb Chaim Volozhin, and then he died, and his son took over. See, there you go. And the son died. The son didn't have a son, I think. And so the question was, should it go to the son-in-law, or should it go like to the grandson or something like that? So the son-in-law was the nativ, and the grandson or nephew, I think, I'm not in front of my books, was the Yosef Soloveitchik. Everybody I'm talking about is A-plus level, genius, you know, like that, big gonim. And the Volozhin Yeshiva was the place, the only real Litvish Yeshiva of the new sort at that time, We're talking the 1850s. And so for about 10 years, from 1853, let's say to 1865, if you want to get exact, there were two people that ran the yeshiva, A and B. And it's okay with me. And truth of the matter is, it's an A-plus team. Dinit Siv was big in his way. The Beis HaLevi was big in his way. But apparently, the politics was such that the question, Miesha Barosh, you know, who's going to be the head one, and probably the students divided into two factions, and their style of learning was different. Although, that shouldn't be a problem. Actually, in a yeshiva, you have two Rebbeim whose style of learning is different, I think is a plus. Because you can, some people will be attracted to this one, and some people attracted to this one. When I was in Neir Israel in my day, you know, Rabbi Rudin was one type, Rabbi Weinberg was certainly a different type, Rabbi Kolevsky was a different type, Rabbi Dover Kron was another type. That's all a plus. It's not a minus. But whatever the case is, as I think many are familiar, there was a big fight over who should run the show. And by the time it's over, the Netziv won. And he should be the head. Yeshiva Soloveitchik apparently didn't like that. Now, hear me well. He didn't challenge the ruling. There was like a Beis Din got together, and that's the Paskin. So he said, if that's it, that's it. But he didn't want to stay there in a position of number two. Even though the Netziv kind of begged him. So here's a boy, our hero of today's yard site, Chaim Soloveitchik, who's born in 1853, the year the Bitzel died, mamish in a world of machlokas, so to speak. But it didn't affect him, at least as far as I know. And indeed, so when he's mamish 12 years old, I like to, dates matter, you know, geography and dates matter. Here's Chaim Soloveitchik growing up in a house where his father is this, and his he was also related to Netziv in some way also. You know, and it's the best yeshiva of that time, and he's got the best heads and the best guys, and this is the world he's growing up in, and he's a native-born genius. Reb Chaim Brisker was, without question, one of these Mozart types, you know, from the age of two or three or four, something like that. He already had extremely brilliant minds. There are some people like that. And before his bar mitzvah, you know, 1865, would put him at 12 years old. So his father leaves Voloshin, then it seems, said, please stay. He said, no, thank you. And he went off to try his hand at the rabbinate. I think first he was in Slutsk, if I remember correctly, at the Beis HaLevi, and then later on in Brisk, as we know. And that's why they call him Brisker Rav. So I'm talking about the father now, the Beis HaLevi. So here's this Chaim growing up at the age of 12. By the time he's 13, so the family's already left Voloshin. And they went to this Slutsk. These are all towns not so far away from each other. You know, they're all in Belarus and Lithuania. They're not so far from each other. And says bar mitzvah, and then his teenage years. And obviously, he's learning with his father. And like I said before, both are geniuses, so you can just figure out what that is. I saw somewhere, and it could be, that for his bar mitzvah, the father said something along the lines, here's a Rambam, you figure out the kasha that I'm thinking of and tell me the teretz I'm going to come up with. And he did. So that's a little bit different than the usual bar mitzvah pshat. You know what I mean? Even if a guy sits there and memorizes a whole Dvar Torah and all the rest of it, and a whole lumdus and a pilpul, but here's a better one. Go figure out what I would ask, and go figure out what I would say. And so automatic, you're dealing with genius range over here. So here's somebody that learns, not in the yeshiva. So you hear what I'm saying? Not in Voloshin yeshiva. He learns basically by the time he's 12, which are your yeshiva years. So during his teens, he's learning in Slutsk, wherever, with his father, which is just interesting. You know, some of the real geniuses didn't go to yeshiva. And then when he's 20 years old, so after these 8 years of learning, you know, when I say by himself, obviously, it was a town, there was a Beis Medrash, there were guys learning there, winners and losers, the father is a genius, they probably learned most time with the father. You know, this is the upbringing that we have over here. They say when he was young, mamish young, he was a chavrusa with, who was the Rugachev, I think, which is kind of interesting. Got two geniuses, one of the weird variety, one of the less weird variety, and the Rugachev being the weird one. And there are many stories in Meisselach about that. I don't know if they're true or not, but I'll tell you one thing. It's interesting. You look at the Rogachev's writings, there's a very similar sometimes, it's busy with endless chakiris. I've noticed that. And, you know, definitions and things like this that you see later on in Reb Chaim Brisker stuff. So maybe when they were kids, they already worked it out. At least the beginnings of that style. Anyway, so here's Chaim Brisker. So he's not Brisker. He's Chaim Soloveitchik. And when he's 20 years old, he gets married. Now listen closely. He gets married to the granddaughter of the Netziv, which means that from day one, the Netziv, even though he won the fight, who should be the head of the Lashon, he always wanted the Beis HaLevi there. He wanted the brain power. The Beis HaLevi did not wish to do that. They say, that he already saw when the Beis HaLevi left, and he had a 12-year-old son, Chaim, and he already saw the guy's off-the-wall genius. He wanted right then and there to say, let's make a shidduch, my granddaughter, with your son, you know, in 5 or 8 years or something like that, and basically refused. But in the end, it did happen. So what that means is that they're talking about 1873 now. So he's born in 1853, and I'm talking about when he's 20, it was 1873. These are the peak years of the Haskalah, I might point out, in Russia. These are the peak years of the anti-Frum Haskalah, which is just an interesting thing to keep in mind. And but then when he's 20 years old, so he marries the Netziv's granddaughter, the daughter of a full Volozhiner, and he moved back to Volozhin. So here's somebody who lived for the first 12 years of his life in Volozhin, then had an 8-year interval, and then came back. When he came back, so he's 20 years old, he's Rashiba's grandson, but he's also a super genius. And not only when I say super genius, I don't simply mean in the sense he knows Shas and that sort of thing, but, you know, his thinking was very impressive to people. He was already becoming a Chaim, you know, the one who was Mechadish, new ways of analyzing Gemaras and especially Rishonim. And already, guys were attracted to him. So here's the politics. There's the Volozhin Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva is the Netziv, the number two Rosh Yeshiva, the guy who took Beis Levi's place, was the Netziv's son-in-law. Surprise, surprise. But now this Chaim Soloveitchik is the son-in-law of that son-in-law. So he does have an official position teaching yeshiva. From day one, he's got what we would call today chaburas. You know, where guys just attracted, want to talk to him and learning. And it must have been some impressive situation there back in the 1870s where just people huck around in Beis Medrash and outside of Beis Medrash in his approaches to learning. And he took Ian to new levels, and he thought on kashas for weeks and weeks and talked with guys over. And he also had a magnetic personality. He was the opposite of standoffish. And that's one of the interesting things over here. He's a super chevroman all of his life. And I mean that in a good way. And, you know, he would walk around and talk to people, and besides the learning, just to be a social and friendly guy. It's just a remarkable combination. You put it all together, people like really attracted to him. And at the age of 30, no, I said it wrong, at the age of 27, his father-in-law took a job as a rabbi in a big community somewhere else, which means that the job for number two was open to him, and it was given to him. So he's the son-in-law of the Rosh Yeshiva, and so now he becomes number two, the second Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin. And the Netziv had no problem because he's family, okay? Well, not exactly true, because the Netziv had a son of his own, Chaim Berlin. He wanted him in, but the difference is that Chaim Soloveitchik was a genius, and a super attractive chevra guy, a very social type person. He was very beloved by the student body, or large portions of it. And the son of the Netziv was not. So that's, you know, the politics at that time, but I'll leave that aside. So now, from the age of 27, I mean, just think about what I'm saying. Everything comes together. He's 27 years old, and at the peak of his powers. He's the Magid Shir, the main Magid Shir, really, because the Netziv was always running around raising money and things like that. So he gave shiurim, but the day-to-day sort of thing was the Chaim Soloveitchik, who everybody liked, number one, and number two was, you know, just brilliant. So in those, you have the right guy at the right time. And these are considered like the peak years of the Volozhin Yeshiva. Next 12 years of his life, from the age of 27 to what? To, you know, to 39. So in these years, young man, in these years, he was giving the main shiur in Volozhin Yeshiva, and he attracted a whole bunch of guys to him, elite group, and he seems to have been a natural pedagogue in the sense that, you know, he threw a kasha out, have the guys talk it over, then he'll critique them. He said, what do you guys think the answer is? And here's what I think the answer is. And, you know, try to work away the superficialities of it until you come up with his way of analyzing and analysis and all that. And by the time it's over, you know, they really work through this real well and they feel great about it. They weren't high. So somebody of Rosh Yeshiva can do that, obviously, is a fantastic thing. And so a lot of the big people, Reb Chaim had a lot of students, that's what I'm trying to say. A lot of big rabbis, the next generation, have been students under him in Volozhin. And if it was up to him, he could spend the rest of his life doing this, because after all, it doesn't get better. If that's who you are, it doesn't get better. You're Rosh Yeshiva in Lamaisa, the Magashir, in the best yeshiva anywhere in Volozhin, with the best guys, the best heads, and all that sort of thing. And you can go on like that till you die. I mean, what more do you want? Okay? That's the type of person, if he won the lottery, he just put the money in the bank, whatever, and keep doing exactly what he's doing anyway, because he's doing exactly what he wants to do. However, fate intervened, and before he was 40 already, the yeshiva closed down. The Russian government closed down the yeshiva. That's a whole story by itself. I won't get into now, even though I could. You know, kind of a piece of that story. But anyway, for better or worse, the yeshiva was closed down by government rules, order. And not only that, but the two Russian yeshivas, the Netziv, who was an old man, and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was a young man, who was in his late 30s, were ordered by the authorities that they have to leave the area. They're not allowed to reside in the provinces near the Volozhin Yeshiva. They have to go somewhere else in the Russian Empire and Pale Settlement. That's what these mamzerim were. I mean, what were they afraid they're going to do? Start a revolution? You know. But anyway, and so that's how the Netziv had to go and relocate in Warsaw, where he's buried. And Reb Chaim was with him for a while. I think the Netziv died after a year from a heartbreak. And then Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, like, what's he going to do? And So here's somebody 40 years old. He has a full life ahead of him. All he knows how to do and all he wants to do is what he was doing. To be a magashir and think in the heavy lumdus, in new styles of lumdus, which he's famous for. And that's it. Shifti veis Hashem kol yimei chayai. Lach says v'no Hashem. You know, that's it. So the only thing he can do is try to reconstitute the Volozhin Yeshiva to some degree or another. And so he went around looking at different communities to become a rabbi there, but the real idea is that the rabbinate will be a tuffle to the yeshiva. In other words, here's a town. I remember Pinsk was an important center, so he was in negotiations with Pinsk that they'll bring him in. They know he's a genius. But with the condition, like the old days, that they'll agree he can move X number of guys there and he'll take a lot of the former students from Volozhin and relocate them in Pinsk, which is in southern Belarus. I was there. Northern Ukraine, and things like that, to this town, to this town. By this time, his father, who had been in the rabbi in Slutsk, had fought with the Balabatim because the Soloveitchiks were very proud, and they considered it wrong to kiss up to the rich and the wealthy, and that doesn't get you too far in the rabbinate in those days. And by the time the story's over, you know, he quit on Slutsk. But I'm talking about the Beis Halevi. But then he ended up in Brest-Litovsk, which is another important community. And by this time, you know, Reb Chaim did not want that position. His father had it, but the father died suddenly. And at the funeral, they announced, you know, the father just died. We hereby elect the son. Sometimes partisans of one candidate used to do that in Europe. That's how the Chassam Sofer's son got elected also. At the funeral, they announced Yechi Adonai Moreinu Rabbeinu. This is the new Rav of the city. And therefore, he found himself in an entirely new role at the age of 40. And this role, he spent the rest of his life. So in other words, and he's not a Rosh Yeshiva anymore. So here's the famous Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was the Spitz Rosh Yeshiva. And the Spitz, which gives you the Magashir, which gives you the total, what's the right word, freedom. Not to worry about the rabbinate, not to worry about Paskei Shilas, not to worry about giving speeches for sure, and just learning because you like to do it. And be ma'ayin in the Shas and the Rishonim especially, and, you know, think it through. The kind of thing that most of us don't have time to do, even if they have inclination, because you have a life, you have a job, you have a carpool, you have this, that, and the other. Daf Yomi ain't what I'm talking about at all, guys. Not at all. I'm talking about taking some sugya and sitting on it till you get it right, that requires a lot of time and space and effort, and a lot of people don't have it. And he had it until then. But from then on, from 1893, I think, or 1894, when he's 40, 41 years old, to the rest of his life, so let's say he died at 66, spent the next 25 years of his life or so, 26 years, he's a rabbi of a community, which is a different role. And not only a little village, Brisk was a town, you know, thousands of people, Jews I'm talking about. And as this Hotgekocht, you know, this is the 1890s, early 1900s, so like all places in the Pale Settlement in Russia, you got your from, you got your unfrom, you got your communists, you got your Bundists, you got your Zionists of every sort, you know, the from are divided between those who are Mizrahi and those who are anti-Mizrahi. I mean, Russian Empire was an interesting place, Judaically, in those years. And here's somebody with zero experience in this. That's the biographers who are intelligent notice this. Because, like I said before, until now, his life was just pure learning and lumdas with great guys. And it never did work out for him to set up a yeshiva of his own in Brisk, in the new town. Notice, he didn't simply pick up a lushan and say, we're making a new yeshiva, because yeshiva requires a huge amount of administrative effort and things like that, and it didn't happen. Instead, what happened was that he always maintained, like a kibbutz, you know, in other words, I don't know how many, X number of really good guys. If you want to really learn hot and heavy, then you come to the Brisk if he'll accept you, and it's not a yeshiva exactly, but it's more like a gigantic chabura. I guess that might be the right word, in which you can hock with these guys. But you realize the head is a rav. And being a rabbi of a community in Russia, of a kehillah, I mean an autonomous, coercive community, well, or whatever was left of that by the time you get to the end of the 19th century. Being a rav means you got to be sitting on top of the dayanim and making sure the kashrus is done right. The chinuch is always a battle. So there's a Talmud Torah committee, and you got to make sure that's being fought correctly. And I don't know, you know, and you got the cemetery stuff to take care of, and the, you know, the Stam Kehillah politics and the taxation that the Kehillah does, and this and that and the other. And so being a Rav is like a very time-consuming, let's put it that way, time-consuming kind of a role. And this is what he undertook to do for the rest of his life. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't have time for learning, but it wasn't what it was. And the thing is like this, but a genius and a macharish of a macharish of a new way of doing shas and rishonim, he was. And so it's funny, and he tried to have both roles. Now, speaking historically, it's very, very, I'm trying to figure out how to say this. So Chaim Soloveitchik came to be the rabbi in the Brisk, but he basically let it be known he's not there to paskin shalos all day long. You have a beis din. He brought in a friend of his, Reb Simcha Zelig Rieger, and you know he should handle all the regular shalos. There are many mashas like this. I mean, there's a famous story. A lady came with a chicken question, and you know they used that to do in Europe. You know, you check the chicken. If anything looks funny, show it to Rav. He's got to say it's kosher or not kosher. And an old lady came to him and she says, "I want you to tell me whether the chicken's kosher," which rabbis dealt with all the time in the old country. And he said, "Go ask the Dayan." She said, "Oh, this is an easy one. Even you can answer it." You know, so that kind of rabbanus he wasn't into. So he wasn't like a ritzal chanan, let's put it that way, you know, of the halachic nature. He didn't have shalos and tshuvos, meaning he didn't publish any, he didn't assemble any, as far as I know. Quite the contrary. There's a very famous story, maybe you've heard it or not, told by, who was it, from Volozhin Bizir, from Mayor Berlin, that there was a certain question about a get, and the Dayanim were divided over whether the get was okay or not, if I remember correctly, story. And, you know, since the Dayanim are arguing over it, they went to Reb Chaim, who's the Rav, the Av Beis Din, and he said, sent the shayla to Reb Yitzchak Elchanan, who was alive at that time, but just tell him to send back a telegram with, you know, one line. It's to get as good or it's not good. Don't explain to me why. Because if you say why, I'm going to end up upschlagging it, you understand? And I don't want to do that because the Reb Yitzchak Elchanan Spector is the posek, And, we'll go with his Das Torah. If you want to come down to the Svaras behind it, I might not agree with his argumentation, and therefore I won't be able to agree with his conclusion, and I want to. Let me say this. If you want to understand, I'm speaking now to a broad audience. If you want to understand, somebody like Chaim, the source, there ain't that many great books that I'm aware of out there. There's now this new biography of two fat books I saw in the bookstore. Maybe I own one. I don't remember. Or maybe I lent it out. They translate in English. There are three places I would send people if they want to familiarize themselves and anything beyond the dumb superficial level. So Chaim Brisker. If you're a yeshiva guy that knows that I learn, you can do your Chiddush of Chaim al Rambam on your own. Good for you. But I'm talking about to the mass of people out there. One is Rav Zevin, who I mentioned before, and he has Ishim Beshitos. And I remember in the Ishim Beshitos, he has an amazing essay on Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, in which, if you want to get an idea of the style of learning of Rav Chaim, you won't get a better introduction than there, in my humble opinion. Because he has about 20 or 30 or 40 examples of Rav Chaim's lamdas. The things that many of you have heard about, the chakiras, the difference between a chavetz and a gavra, between two dinim, what's a shame, all that sort of thing, and the very subtle and, which I say, fine-tuned reasoning that he brings to all these complex sugyas, and Rav Zevin can explain it. But you got to be able to read Hebrew. I'm sorry about that. No, it's not in English. That's something the Yorick Scroll should do, but it would take a lot of editing, baby. But that would really be a public service. And now maybe I'm fooling myself. Maybe there's not a public out there be interested in it. But I think there is. I think if they ever did Ishim Beshitos, even the one of Chaim, because I'll tell you again, he has one example after another of all of his famous stuff. It's quite remarkable. The thing when Chametz, whether it's Chepz or Gavra, or the thing about Adim Zobman, in Makas, what's Kasher Osa and what's Kasher Zomam, all the famous Rav Chaims. He gives them in short paragraph or two, the bullet ways. And I really, so for me to sit here, I'm not going to end up, I do not want to end up doing what I did last time with Ritzel Petterberg and go over an hour. I'm trying to hold this down. So I'm not going to give examples of the new style of learning of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, although I'm tempted to. Maybe I'll do a podcast one time with different styles of learning. But meanwhile, let's keep it biographical. And if you follow through this, you'll see the new ways of approaching Shas, and especially with Shonen, particularly the Rambam and the Ravid, but not only. That was considered really new and novel, and really swept the yeshiva world, the Lithuanian yeshiva world. But he also describes Chaim as in his role as a posek, or not posek, and he was a posek, but not in a classical sense. He wasn't a halachist like a Rizal Chana Spector. Now, why not? He had the brains for it, obviously. And the reason is very interesting. Somebody who's a machadish, a new thinker, somebody's bringing new approaches to Rishonim and Gemaras, is going to have a problem with the regular halachic system. Because the regular halachic system is based on evolution over many centuries, and you have certain svaras that just get out there and are accepted by the poskim down the centuries. And these svaras may or may not make sense to you, the individual, coming at it with a totally fresh approach. And what you'll end up doing is saying, well, I don't care what anybody says. I went through the Gemara and the Rishonim, and this is the din. Not what it says in the Shulchan Aruch, or not what it says in the Shach, or not what it says in, the Ramar or something like that. But rather, this is what it is. Now, to be perfectly honest, that is theoretically the best way to go. Ein l'dayan el mashe nevro. So, you give it your best shot. You go through the basic sources. I'm talking about the Shas and the Rishonim and all that. And then you paskin as you see it. But a firm person doesn't feel comfortable doing that. You're not going to go after centuries and centuries of minug that this is, the way has been decided over the centuries in Klal Yisrael that this say you paskin on the get, or on the matzah, or on the sukkah, or on the Hilchos Nida or something like that. So you end up having to say that, you know, what I'm doing is quote unquote theoretical. I'm not entering the area of practical halacha. And that's reflected in that story I just said. So Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector may end up posking that this get is good or not. And he'll give me his reasoning. And I know the Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector is coming from the mainline classic mode of Psak halacha, which is why he was considered the Gadol HaDor in Psak. And I'm coming from my approach, and I'm naturally going to think that my approach is better because I worked it out myself. And I don't want to be somebody who's breaking the tradition and the consensus. It's really a very interesting thought if you think about it. I hope I haven't spoken too abstractly, but those who understand what I just said will understand what I just said. Anyway, now here's another thing. When he became the rabbi in this town, so what exactly posture do you assume? If it's not a posek, and it's not a Rosh Hashiva, so what exactly is it? Here's, you know, something very fascinating. Rav Chaim Brisker picked the right way to be a Rav, and that is to be an outstanding personality based on the totality of who he was. And in order to understand what I'm talking about, Chaim Soloveitchik, when he became the Rabbi Brisk, became famous in many circles, not simply as the big learner and all that, but he had a gigantic personality and a heart. He didn't care for money. There weren't too many people like that. When he got married, they gave him, you know, 1,000 rubles as a dowry. He gave it away. He said, "What do I need it for? I'm being supported by a father-in-law anyway." Later on, rich people come in, you know, for one reason or another, and give him a big wad in an envelope, but he give the envelope away without showing it to the family. He's the guy they talk about. It really happened that, you know, when they gave him the salary, he gave it away to the poor. His house was open 24/7. And that's not an exaggeration on my part. His house was like a Rosh Hashanah. It was expected poor people to come in, and they felt at home and, you know, lie down on the floor and sleep there at night with all the dirt and everything that goes along with that. Businessmen would come and put up posters for their business in his living room and in his dining room because the house of the rabbi is the house of the community. And he was totally fine with that. A poor person, he would go crazy trying to help the guy. I'm talking about losers. I'm talking about schleppers. I'm talking about almanas. I'm talking about people that usually a rav didn't bother with. You're supposed to have committees that's supposed to deal with these sorts of things. And he became famous as a big tzaddik. You know what I'm saying? Tzaddik in the classic sense of somebody who'll give the shirt off his back or work real hard for you to do so. Now, ordinarily, you say like this. Have somebody who's your gabbai tzedakah. You sit and learn because your excellence is in the learning area, which no question it was. It was a genius at that. And yet, that's not how he acted. If some poor shnook came in and needed some kind of help to get a job or something, he actually went out and worked his head off to try to help the guy. It's like crazy. He became known as Avihai Ha'almanas, Avihai Yisama, Avihai Aniyam, you know, people like that. And therefore, the people in Brisk, in those areas, they didn't talk about him as a big genius or learning, because that's out of their league. They have no idea what they're talking about. They would say, you know, he helped my brother, he helped my wife, he helped my kids. people would leave babies on his front step, because the kids were either illegitimate or were born out of wedlock. And, you know, this is Eastern Europe, so imagine you go from a nice family, she got pregnant, it could happen, and what do you do with the baby? And, you know, leave it by the rabbi, and he'll take care of it. And, you know, what is he, a one-man, you know, welfare department? The answer is yes. He made himself a one-man welfare department. And there are stories and stories and stories about this, and these stories are true because these stories are told by non-frum people. Yes, these are people who didn't like the frum kite stuff, but nevertheless said like this, you can't take it away. Chaim Soloveitchik is a tzaddik yisod olam. The chassidim went crazy over him. You know, there's many stories along these lines. So therefore his smarts, he had to switch from the learning. I don't say he stopped learning, but I'm saying his smarts, he had to switch away from learning to become a people person and help people out. He became known as a big bal tzedakah. Let's put it this way. Anybody out there was in bad shape. Guy lost a job, a guy's looking for a Rebbe position, a guy's looking, he went to Rav Chaim, you know, in Brisk, and he would really try to help. He wouldn't tell anybody, I'm sorry, I can't help, or this, that, and the other, go to another rabbi or something like that, and he put himself out there, and the stories are legion. I remember I saw some non-from person, I think it was, maybe it was Evan, I can't remember. Listen to this. A lady came in, she said, I guess I'm expecting in a month. Everybody's turned me away. I'm starving. I don't know what's going to be with the baby, all the rest of it. And he said, the story is, Rechaim said to his wife, aren't the women, don't the women have, committees to handle this sort of thing? And because Briskov's a city with a community, a Jewish community means you have vods. You have committees. You know, there's a vod for tzedakah, a vod for this, and a vod for that, like we have in America today, We in America, we have things called the Chaverim and the what do you call it, the Shomrim and, the this and that and the other, Masaskim, whatever. So they had the equivalents of those in Europe. And his wife, the story is that the Rebbesin, Chaim's wife, said to him, he says, this is a bummer because, let's put it this way, this lady's pregnant and her husband's been away for 2 years. So knows this child's going to be illegitimate. And Chaim said, that's got nothing to do with anything. You know, it's a human being. We got to help her out. And the other stuff we'll sort out later. And I think, if I remember correctly, he put her up in his house, and she gave birth there. And they brought in nurses, and she stayed there for months or whatever. Like crazy stories, you understand? I'll tell you again. I know this. I've seen poor people. So have you. People would come in and say like this: Can I cook dinner over here? Total strangers. What they have a little bit of food in their pot or something like that. But he's got a fire, they can do it. And basically, his house was a hotel, and it was a court. And by the way, one room was where the bezdin is sitting. Another room, he was talking with guys and learning. So it was an unbelievable balagan, and he liked it. And so what it means is, he was the servant of the public, and even the non-from couldn't take away from him. They said like this, maybe he's a little too from for us, but... This is what the non-from said. Maybe it's a little too from for us because from he super was. He was against the Zionists. He was against the Mizrahi. He's the founder, one of the founders of the Agoda, even though the Agoda didn't turn out the way he thought it was. But he may be too from, but on the other hand, you can't take it away. He will give the shirt off his back. He will, drive himself crazy. There's a famous story. How's it go? Some communist Bundists were arrested by the Russian police, or maybe it was the First World War or something like that. And it's a very famous Misa, and it was Yom Kippur, and they didn't have the money necessary to bribe the Goyim, because of Chaim, there's no fooling around. You don't appeal to the Russians. You don't, call the International Court of Human Rights. It's a bribery. That's what it is. That's how this country runs. And so if people are in trouble, you just have to raise the money to pay off the right person to get them out, as they gate this. And the story was that it was, like Friday, the night of Yom Kippur, and he told the shuls nobody can start davening Maariv until I say so. And he went from place to place, and he made all these guys, he'd call out every rich guy from every shul and say, I guess, we need this and this amount of money, you're going to give it now. And the guy would say so piously, oh, it's already Yontov, I can't give any money. And Chaim said, I'm telling you, don't give me that baloney. I need this and this amount of money. And he raised the money. And this was for Bundes, this was for anti-front people. Trying to tell you, No, this is not for saving yeshiva guys or anything like that. A yid is a yid, a Jew is a Jew. And you put it into practice. In addition to Rav Zev, so I think if you read, take the trouble, those who can, if you read Zevin's essay, it's you'll see a lot of these sorts of things in there. And I think you'll be impressed. There's another book also, by Yaakov Mark, the Yiddish guy. Gedolim from Unter Zeit, the guy who was in the ocean city of Lithuania, in Palangan, actually he was in Liepau, and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to go there. Here you see a human being side. I always like the human being. So it's a brilliant essay, but unfortunately, again, it's in Yiddish. Maybe it's been translated to Hebrew. Has been translated to Hebrew. The Hebrew is censored. Not that the censorship at all, but I remember the Hebrew is censored. The Yiddish one is great. Gedolim from Unter Zeit. He was in, like I say, the ocean city, the Atlantic city of Lithuania, in Courland, which is Latvia, actually. And Rav Chaim used to come there every summer because in those years they had a diagnosis called neurasthenia, which today is considered baloney. And that was that your health problems, certain type of people like Rav Chaim, your health issues, and he had health issues, bad liver and this and that and the other, stem from overuse of the brain. You're working too hard. And therefore, the therapy is to chill, like for a month, you know? So you have to go and, you know, go to Atlantic City or something like that and just chill, walk on the boardwalk, as we'd say today. And since the doctor said at that time they thought that it really was true, which today isn't, so they took it seriously. So Chaim used to go to this guy's bungalow, as we would say today, and so they were buddies. And the guy who writes this, Yaakov Mark, was a frum guy, but he was a Mizrahi guy. And so, but he used to buddy up with Reb Chaim, and they would walk for hours on the beach or sometimes go swimming together naked, because that's what he did in the 19th century. When he comes out, he couldn't let his mind do absolutely nothing. So they played tic-tac-toe, and they did math games, or they talked in science and physics and things. It's quite remarkable. And so he got to know him quite well. And that's the human being side. I wish that was translated in English. Maybe, I don't believe it is. Now you see the human being side of Chaim, who was a super chevroman. I remember this story. He said, I remember two or three stories offhand. He said that, you know, if Reb Chaim came to the town, so obviously he's going to raise tzedakah for needy people, because people weren't stupid. As soon as you heard he's going to Atlantic City, everybody's going to Atlantic City. All the people want smicha, all the people that want help to find a new shteller, all the poor people want an extra buck, all the people looking for money for you know, what do you call it, dowry for the daughter, you know, that sort of thing. And so they all zero in on this town, which gets invaded by the needy, and they all want to see Chaim Brisker. And I remember, so this guy who writes this essay, he was like a leader in the community there. And he and a couple guys would get together and raise money, you know, a couple thousand rubles, whatever, because they knew Chaim would come and have a tzedakah list. And one year, Chaim came there and he said, "Who's in charge of the tzedakah?" He says, "Me and this other guy raised the money for you." He said, "Well, the din is you need three people. So, you know, for a vod for a tzedakah, you need three people. So I'll be the third." They said, "Okay, fine." As soon as he said, "Now that I'm the third," so Chaim then immediately went like this. He wrote out a list of an extra 100 people who need tzedakah. They said, "Where'd this come from?" He said, "Now I'm a member of the committee, so I'm telling you. And here comes Mr. A. I know him very well. You got to give him 1,000 rubles." "1,000 rubles? We ain't got nothing like that." "Can't give anything less. Here's B. Oh, he's in bad shape. He needs 1,500 rubles. Here's C. This is a lady who's got a sob story, and I know about it. She needs at least 2,000 rubles. And by the time it's over, they said, you know, we raised like 5,000 or 6,000, which was a lot of money. By the time I'm finished, by the time you're finished, it's 20,000. He said, "Well, tough luck. It's your job to go raise it." So they raised the money with great difficulty. But the next year, when he came that summer, they said, "I guess we already have a committee of three. You're not wanted, you know." And he said, "Oh, you're a bunch of wise guys," which means he was a clever man too. You know, he could play ball with them. And many of these stories. But since it's the hour's late, I'm going to run into an hour. So I just want to make the following observation, speaking in broad historical terms. And then, because to speak of Reb Chaim, you can go on and on, as you can see. I think you get an idea over here. Broad historical terms. Reb Chaim Brisker was the main intellectual, I would say, of the Lithuanian Yeshiva movement in the second half, starting from the time that he got involved in the 1870s, in particular 1880s, and the new style associated with him of analysis, what's called the Brisker analysis, which I'm sure you can find on the internet, you know, because especially YU guys and all that, since probably Yeshiva Be'er Salvation was a YU and others, I think they write about a lot in English. Or you can do the Zevin article, like I told you before. Here's the point. This new way of thinking, like, you know, conquered the Yeshiva world. They said this is fresh. And what it engendered was a feeling that very similar to what's going on in the secular world, in the outside European culture. The 19th century was a time in which old modes of thinking and analysis were replaced by new. Think of the technological advances of the 19th century. In the beginning of the 19th century was a horse and wagon. By the end of the 19th century, you're almost owned by airplanes. You already had a beginning of cars and railroads, of course, steam engines, telegraph. It was a revolutionary way of thinking in every area of endeavor. And it's totally understandable that lots of Jews were drawn to the European culture because this is new, this is correct, and all the old stuff is out the window. You know, it's been replaced. the yeshivas in Lithuania were able, through the new ways of learning, like the Brisker style, to have the boys, the guys in yeshiva, think that we're the way we are analyzing Shas and Rishonim is new and sort of displacing and replacing the old. And without saying it, it's like saying the old is no good, but the new way is the most advanced form of Torah study. Most advanced form of Torah study. Now, whether it is or isn't, becomes irrelevant, because the subject of reality is more important than anything else. If you feel this way, then you feel that you are in a super advanced, cutting-edge institution of learning and part of a group of people that represent an advanced guard, an avant-garde of new thinking. And that makes you feel super special. And so if the yeshivas did not engender guys who thought that they're new, they're mechadish, they're super, something special, then the yeshivas would have lost all these kids, the best and the brightest anyway, to the European culture, which really was putting out that message and demonstrating it through scientific and technological advance. It's just fascinating to me that the Lithuanian yeshivas, especially after Reb Chaim, came to unconsciously imitate the most advanced form of Western European intellectuality in terms of institutions. The most advanced form is the postgraduate work, especially in Germany. They had these postgraduate institutions, especially in areas of non-science, like, let's say, for example, law. What was the highest madriga over there? Pure abstraction, which is Reb Chaim, you know, taking ideas and reifying them and bringing out to their conceptual clarity, new novel forms of analysis, trying to bring new forms of classification, many aspects that you find in the German Research Institute. You'll find mutatis mutandis, of course, and the new styles of learning in the yeshivas that came associated with the heroic image of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. And like I said before, it doesn't matter whether you think this is true or not, or the new style is better than the old style, which there's room to discuss. But, you know, putting that aside, if the boys feel this way, then it's a reality. And this is what made the yeshiva sort of like an oasis or an island of imperviousness to the blandishments of modern culture. So it's kind of interesting. You think you got, new ways and intellectual elitism out there in the universities. We got stuff 10 times better, right? 10 times more advanced, 10 times more difficult to understand, and 10 times more abstract. Now, like I said before, that could be boasting, could not be boasting, could be true, not be true. If people feel this way, then you create a world of a super elitism, and that's what the Lithuanian yeshivas cultivated. A sense of super elitism, they still do. And without that, you wouldn't be able to have kids who say, I'm not going to go to college. You know, without that, you wouldn't have large numbers of kids who say, I want to belong to an alternative culture. Today, in the modern world, for various reasons, the year 2019, the yeshivas are now an Olam HaYeshivas. It's an alternative universe. It's alternative culture, which is actually quite impressive achievement sociologically in this day and age to sort of turn your back on all the institutions of modernity and create your own, that's remarkable. In my opinion, a major person, or maybe even the major person in the intellectual sense, in this sociological revolution, evolution, the person whose ideas and charisma came to, personify and be regarded as the peak, the apotheosis of this whole cultural way of thinking, is Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. That's quite a statement. Now I could go on and on and on, but since I've run way over time, I was afraid I would do that. I'm going to close the shop down now, and hopefully tomorrow I'll get to that other biography, that other yard set. Reb Chaim Brisker, if you look up, if you take the trouble to do what I told you today, you get number one, the Zevin, that shouldn't be hard, the Yishim B'Shittas. Unfortunately, you got to be able to read Hebrew. Number two, you have to get this Yaakov Mark, Gedolim Funim Tzur Tzeit. At least even if you read the censored one in English, In Hebrew, I think it's called B'mechitzasan shel Gedoli Ador, some name like that. That's also very, very worthwhile. That's the human being side of the Avraham Chaim and Reb Pritzker. And then there's this book I got years ago. I picked it up somewhere called Asufas, Reb Chaim Pritzker, I think it's called. I don't know who it is. It's Roy Moy Nushim. Very little piece of lumdus, very well presented, and usually with some kind of a specific historical background. Is it Lefkowitz, Hershkowitz, one of those names in Eretz Yisrael. I always wondered if there was a second volume. If anybody knows, it's called Asufos, Reb Chaim Pritzker, or something to that effect. I remember Asufot. And if there was a second volume on Kachim and Taurus, that'd be amazing. You know, Nezik and Kachim and Taurus. First one was Roim Mayim Nashim, I think. Second one was Nezik and Kachim and Taurus. Because Zero Chaim has a lot of things to say, as I think everybody knows. But I'm going over my time anyway, and so with that, I bid you a good day.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.